Callie Crossley in for Tanzina Vega this week. Nearly 400 treaties exist in the U.S. to protect tribal lands and hunting and fishing rights, and they have rarely been honored by federal and local governments. But that might be changing. Last month, Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer shut down a controversial pipeline in northern Michigan, citing, among other things, an 1836 treaty that guarantees indigenous rights to hunt and fish in that area. Indigenous treaties are also helping secure environmental wins in other areas. Tribes in Washington State won a case in 2018 to restore their fisheries. And last month, Oregon and California announced plans to remove four dams on the Klamath River based on treaty rights. Asserting treaty rights has the potential to increase environmental protection in many parts of the country, and tribal members invoking treaty rights can sometimes make a stronger legal claim than non-native citizens. But there are so many new treaty violations that they can't be corrected fast enough, and some legal experts worry that sweeping treaty assertions that are unsuccessful in court could set a dangerous precedent. Matthew Fletcher is the director of Michigan State University's Indigenous Law and Policy Center, member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, and a tribal judge. Matthew, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
First off, can you explain how treaties were actually intended to protect the environment and what specifically they protect?
Sure. So treaties really fundamentally, what they do is establish a homeland for Indian people, for Indian tribes. So a treaty typically would say the tribe would sell off its historical traditional territories in exchange for a permanent reservation. And that would usually have some sort of boundary established. So that homeland, that reservation is a homeland. And whatever is contained in that homeland is protected by the treaty specifically. And whatever resources are needed, even outside of the reservation, are protected as well. Things like water, access to wildlife, fish and game, that sort of thing. All of those are protected by the treaty.
When did things start to fall apart with these treaties, and why weren't they respected and enforced?
Things fell apart within a few years of the treaties being negotiated. In most instances, you would see the introduction of settlers from outside the area. They would come in, they would want to come onto reservation lands, or they would want to take control over waters and other resources that the reservation lands depend on. And the United States government very rarely would do anything about those encroachments. In fact, they would often encourage those encroachments. And then over time, the United States Congress would pass laws designed to allow for the introduction of new people into reservation lands and divert resources away from the tribes.
What would the environmental landscape look like in this country if the treaties had been enforced throughout our history?
Well, there would be a lot more trees. There would be a lot more clean water. And there would be more resources available to the tribes. So, you know, that there would be, you know, a greener environmental landscape throughout the country, wherever there is Indian country.
Matthew, is it common to use treaty rights for environmental preservation?
Well, probably not until the last two decades. So treaty rights are usually litigated on the question of access to fish and game or reservation boundaries or reservation lands. But there's always been this implied notion that if a treaty is designed to establish a homeland, then it must be also designed to allow for the preservation of the resources needed to fulfill the purposes of that homeland. So in the West, you'll see a lot of cases in the last few decades where the tribes are talking about, you know, the access to water, even off the reservation, access to fishing game, even off the reservation, to allow for the purposes of the reservation to be fulfilled. And on occasion, you'll see a treaty like the treaties in Michigan and the treaties in Washington State that explicitly allow for access to fishing game off the reservation. Now, what you at the beginning of the program, in the introduction, you talked about a case in 2018 where the courts have affirmed the right or the protection of the environment as a means of fulfilling the purposes of the treaty. you need to have a decent environment in order to have fish and game and clean water. And that kind of litigation is just really beginning. And we're starting to see more and more cases along those lines now.
Were you surprised to see Governor Whitmer use treaty rights as a reason to oppose a pipeline? And what do you think prompted her to do that? And was it politically advantageous to her?
All of that is right. So I was not terribly surprised to see Governor Whitmer refer to treaty rights. Indian tribes have often been allies of the state government when the state government is looking at restricting polluters or restricting the kind of economic activity that creates problems for the environment. So the reference to the treaty of 1836 was a pleasant surprise in that the tribes really have been advocating for many years as a means of cutting back on these threats to the environment. And I guess the surprise comes from the fact that not so many years ago, 1970s, 1980s, the state of Michigan and the tribes were at loggerheads when it came to treaty rights. And the state litigated fervently and went to Congress to try to get the treaty rights abrogated by Congress to make them go away because they were so hostile to the assertion of treaty rights by the tribes. And now we've come full circle where the state is looking at the protection of Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, Lake Superior, et cetera, and it refers to treaty rights to say, well, we've got to protect the rights of our citizens. Indian people are citizens of the state. And so it makes perfect sense now for the state to say, among other things, that the treaty protects the access to that water and the clean water in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron and Lake Superior.
What's the difference between fighting for the right to fish and fighting for the conservation of the resource that allows you to exercise that right?
Well, fighting for the right to fish assumes that there are fish and that there's clean water and a good habitat for the fish. So it requires the tribes, and I suppose the state, if it's going to assert these rights, I guess, on behalf of the tribes, it requires the tribes to prove that there is an additional right inherent in the treaty that in order to have the access to resources like fish, you have to have a clean environment. You have to have a successful habitat for the fish to thrive. So whenever treaty rights are litigated in court, the tribes and whoever is siding with the tribes, be it a state government, be the, or the United States or whomever, has to go back and prove that in, say, 1836, that there was an intent to negotiate for access to fish on and off the reservation. And that's one difficult thing that, you know, is something that has already been done. It's been established. But every time you litigate treaty rights, you have to hire historians, ethnohistorians, anthropologists, experts to write basically a book every single time that you litigate these cases to prove that the Indian people of 1836 believed that that's what the treaty did. And once you've done that to understand access to fish, then you've got to do the additional step of proving that it's access to a clean environment and a successful habitat. And that requires yet another round of complex litigation.
What have we seen in recent years in terms of how government officials relate to these treaties?
So it definitely is a recent trend. You started to see this in the pipeline case, in the pipelines in North Dakota and elsewhere in the Great Plains, where tribes are asserting that a pipeline that runs through traditional territories of Indian tribes is actually foreclosed, is prohibited by treaty rights. So in the case of the Standing Rock Dakota Access Pipeline dispute, the tribes were asserting and still are asserting that if the pipeline breaks or ruptures, then the resulting impact will destroy the access to water that the tribes have negotiated for in their treaty rights, in their treaty to preserve a homeland. So this argument has been made. This type of argument has been made more recently, but it goes all the way back, you know, a century into the 1900s, where the United States Supreme Court acknowledged that the purpose of a reservation is to create a homeland. And in order to have a homeland, you have to have access to water. And this access to water, clean water, and a livable reservation is the core of the argument that is rooted in treaty rights to protect the environment. And you're starting to see these cases again and again. You're starting to see political momentum behind the cases. Tribes don't really like to litigate treaty rights because it's incredibly complex and expensive, but it also puts the core of their legal being to the test in court. And you can never really tell what's going to happen in court, even if you have a really strong legal claim. So politically, however, you don't really have to make all of those arguments. You don't have to prove to a court in a way that that puts things to the test. You can just say, we have these treaty rights. Here's our position on the treaty. Here's our position on the environment. And you can create a sort of phalanx of political power. The tribes lined up to make that argument in a political manner in the political arena, and it's much more successful.
So how has the collaboration of tribes with the climate movement changed the political power that tribes have, if it has?
Well, I think it has. Back in the early days of the treaty rights fights, you would see a lot of non-Indians line up against the tribes to side with the states and say there's no treaty rights to hunt and fish. And they were in opposition to the tribes because they thought that access to fish and game was a sort of a zero-sum game. And we're starting to realize that with the environmental movement and the conservation movement, which tend to be on opposite political sides, we all have the same interests with tribes. And the tribes want to protect the environment so that there's access to fish and game. The conservation movement wants to protect the environment because there's access to fish and game. And the environmental movement is interested in protecting the environment for the purposes of protecting the environment. So we're all lined up. These three groups that at times were at loggerheads over treaty rights are now suddenly on the same side in a lot of these issues. And, you know, you add in the reality that in the past few decades, tribes are large employers regionally in some of these rural areas. And a lot of people are starting to side with the tribes generally because they depend on the tribes for their livelihoods.
Some people say it's a tedious process to try and make a dent in the many, many treaty violations over the past century. Does it make sense legally to use this tactic?
Well, it doesn't. It's incredibly expensive, but at the same time, any time a tribe is threatened, any time a tribe thinks that its treaty rights are threatened or its homeland is threatened, they are willing to make that decision to expend those resources, to put everything on the line. Keep in mind that treaties are the core of the existence in many ways of modern day tribes. If you ever want to get a tribe riled up politically, threaten their treaty rights, and they will absolutely line up against whatever power is making that claim. But it is tedious, and it's very expensive and complex. And it's a much easier argument to make in the political arena than it is in court. But that doesn't stop tribes. I mean, they will absolutely make that argument now. But they've only really been able to do that in the past 4 or 5 decades. And it's for many of the tribes in Michigan and in California, those tribes are really just coming into modern existence with a sense of self-determination since the 80s and 90s. And so for them, it's very much this kind of claim in court or in the political arena is very much a new kind of arrangement, a new situation for them, and a really good one. They're actually able to make decisions for themselves and decide when and where to assert treaty rights.
Now, are you worried about this setting a kind of dangerous precedent?
Well, you're always worried when a tribe goes to court and loses. If you get a court ruling that goes all the way to the United States Supreme Court that says something along the lines of, you know, we're not going to enforce implied treaty rights in the same way that we would enforce explicit treaty rights. And that's always a threat, and it can threaten all tribes. But what we're seeing in the Supreme Court right now is justices like Justice Gorsuch saying that we're not interested in the politics of Indian country. We're not interested in how, you know, what the impacts of these cases are going to be. We're going to read the treaty. We're going to look at the way Indian people understood that treaty at the time it was negotiated. And that's all that matters. And if you have those kind of judges on the bench, they're, you know, what they call textualists. And that's basically the kind of judges that are being appointed to the federal and state benches right now. The tribes are in a really good position, relatively speaking.
How do treaty rights intersect with tribal sovereignty? I think that's something that many people don't understand.
Well, you know, just in the past half century, since the 1970s, tribes have been able to govern themselves. Before the 1970s, the federal government, through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, ran Indian country completely. Tribes were not able to make decisions on how to expend resources. They were often not allowed to assert treaty rights for environmental purposes or any other purposes. The federal government used to be able to decide who the tribes could hire as lawyers, if they could even hire a lawyer. But since the 70s, the tribes have that power now themselves. The federal government has turned over its obligations to the tribes to govern Indian country. And once that happened, it allows tribes to make a choice in any given moment when they feel threatened on their treaty rights issues to make the claim, when and where to make the claim, how to make the claim, which lawyers they're going to hire to make the claim, that sort of thing. And that's how those things intersect. Tribes are very circumspect on how they assert treaty rights. But when they do assert treaty rights, it's a little bit like asserting a nuclear option, especially in court, because it's sort of an existential question for the tribes whenever they go to court on treaty rights. And so they're very careful about picking and choosing moments to make that decision. So in Michigan, for example, the tribes have intervened in all sorts of legal proceedings to challenge the pipeline that runs under Lake Michigan, but they have not yet asserted that there's a treaty right to kick that pipeline out. And if all of these other proceedings fail, and it doesn't really look like they will, maybe then the tribes will make a choice that it's time to bust out the treaty rights claim and assert it then.
So given that, what do you expect to see over the next year in terms of how treaty rights will impact environmental protection?
Well, I think you're going to see a lot of tribes making claims. You know, climate change is a really big deal. You see forest fires in the West. You see pollution of water supplies in the Great Plains. I think tribes at this point are getting ready. They're dusting off the treaty rights arguments. And you might see some really big cases. I think the Standing Rock Sioux case involving the Dakota Access Pipeline is pending in court. You're seeing cases that involve, say, the Shoshone Bannock tribes, preservation of its resources, and suits against polluters are pending in the Supreme Court. And those kinds of things are really important cases that can establish that treaty rights really can protect the environment. And you're going to see, obviously, what's going on with Line 5 under Lake Michigan going to be a really big case right now with the tribes lined up with the state of Michigan against the pipeline company.
Matthew Fletcher is the director of Michigan State University's Indigenous Law and Policy Center, member of the Grand Traverse Band of Ottawa and Chippewa Indians, and a tribal judge. Thank you very much for joining me, Matthew.
Absolutely.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. Since then, New York Public Radio's rigorous journalism has gone on to win a Peabody Award and a DuPont Columbia Award, among others. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.